Money FM 89.3, best of prime time.
You're listening to Prime Time on Money FM 89.3. I'm Rachel Kelly. Now, the launch of the travel bubble arrangement between Singapore and Hong Kong is expected to be delayed further. According to the Straits Times today, officials of both cities are expected to announce the extension of the postponement soon. The extension wouldn't come as a surprise, though, as the seven-day moving average of unknown local cases in Hong Kong as of yesterday was 16, and the threshold agreed by Singapore and Hong Kong is at 5. Joining us now to talk more about the impact of continued travel restrictions on regional economies is Pushan Dant, and he's the Professor of Economics and Political Sciences at INSEAD. Pushan, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show. So, you know, Pushan, we've been speaking over the last few months, and we've now entered the final month of the year of COVID-19. Movement is still restricted globally to curb the spread of the virus. And just as we seem to be taking a few steps forward, another wave comes and it feels like it's washing us back.
So, yes, the going has been difficult and the balance actually has been quite elusive. But we should step back a little bit and take the longer-term perspective. So back in spring and summer, all health experts warned us that the fall-winter is going to be particularly bad. Mm-hmm. And if countries were not careful, lockdowns will become inevitable. And today we see lockdowns in Europe, partial lockdowns, but they're lockdowns nevertheless. The U.S. has imposed restrictions as well. It's going to through a massive wave of COVID cases with some variations across states, counties and cities. Countries like Brazil and India have simply given up. So in contrast, Asia still seems to be doing well. Again, to keep in mind, it's important to remind ourselves, why were the lockdowns imposed in the first place? It is to prevent the healthcare sector from being overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. So the lockdown flattens or bends the curve so that patients do not die from a lack of care. So we want to avoid the experience of Wuhan, initially of Bergamo in Italy, of New York City, where the hospitals got overwhelmed and the virus sort of exploded everywhere, especially in elder care homes. So this basic point gets lost in the debate between lives and livelihoods. Yes, there is a trade-off in the short term, but if hospitals are overrun with COVID cases, the lockdowns become essential, and then they have to be more severe and longer. So we just have to be a little bit more patient, take a longer-term perspective. We should also keep in mind that we have learned a lot in terms of managing the disease, how to take care of the sick, which medications work. So mortality rates have actually plummeted significantly. The best estimate shows that the case fatality rate has fallen by about 20%. So we are doing much better than in the earlier waves. We just have to be a bit more patient.
And let's talk about how some of the other global economies are handling travel. I mean, I spoke briefly just now in the intro about the extension of the delay for the Singapore-Hong Kong travel bubble. But looking over to Japan, because Japan has launched an interesting internal travel campaign, and that sparked some debate as some are questioning the subsidy program, which encourages people to travel, and its impact on the spread of COVID-19. What are your thoughts on that?
So Japan has had a travel ban on outsiders, but it has never had a very stringent lockdown. Now, some attribute its best performance to the Japanese culture of masking, maintaining distance, and avoiding the three C's, which is closed spaces, crowded places, and close contact settings. But it's important to realize that these explanations are hypotheses. They cannot be substantiated. In fact, they were recently questioned by a recent article in the British Medical Journal. It's equally likely that they just got lucky. The first wave, they had low infections. In the second, it was concentrated in entertainment districts where, you know, they could do contact tracing and isolate the cases. Now, Japan, like Singapore, has solely relied on contact tracing and isolation. So this works as long as the number of cases remain low and they are sort of geographically confined. Currently, they have about 2,000 cases per day. So cases are popping up in a diverse range of places and geographies. So there are simply too many cases and too long chains to stop community spread. So this has to be supplemented with testing, just like South Korea did. But Japan, like Singapore, has not had adequate tests. So how did Singapore do better? Well, given that both followed the same regime of contact tracing and isolation. Well, this is where size comes in. Singapore's smaller size means contact tracing is far more effective, even in the absence of testing. Japan's larger size and dispersed population means that contact tracing will fail faster. And this go-to travel program that subsidizes as much as 50% of travel expenses inside Japan has made things worse. So the subsidy scheme actually has been rolled back in a couple of places like Osaka and Sapporo. Mm-hmm. And I expect it will be rolled back further if the cases continue to rise.
And moving away from balancing travel to boost the economy, let's take a different angle to this, because besides re-stimulating the economy through tourism, let's talk about the economic benefit of vaccine manufacturing to economies such as India, because India has announced just a few days ago that it's going to be producing Russia's Sputnik V.
So I think first we should be a little bit careful about Russia's Sputnik V vaccine, because the jury is still out on the Russian vaccine. They claim that it's 95% effective, but if you look at the data, there are only 20 people in this study, which is not sufficient.
Right.
In fact, with such a small sample size, the FDA and US would not approve it. They would say, go back and do your homework before you submit your assignment again. From India's perspective, I think the more promising vaccines are the AstraZeneca vaccine. So many companies like the Serum Institute, which is the world's largest vaccine manufacturer, has already started producing millions of doses of AstraZeneca vaccine, even before the stage three trials were completed. Currently, they're churning out about 500 doses a minute. So I think it's not just about production and boosting the economy, because these tend to be quite capital intensive. It's more about providing access. Now, that's going to be tricky as well, because, you know, the Serum Institute, in a sense, is the hope for the world, because they are the only supplier to poor countries. But this is going to be complex, because there's going to be lots of political pressures within India from different world leaders, NGOs, etc. But India remains the key to the world seeing the back of this pandemic.
We're speaking with Bhushan Dutt, Professor of Economics and Political Sciences at INSEAD. Bhushan, you know, we're now heading towards the end of the year and just moving along. What's your assessment on the lasting impact of COVID-19 on regional economies and perhaps even the region's political landscapes?
So let me talk a little bit about economics and then switch to politics. So countries in Asia, especially in Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia and China, have done very well in terms of controlling the virus. Many of these countries have also been very practical in the sense of they've deployed very aggressive monetary policies and provided massive fiscal relief. This was the right thing to do. It was a gamble at that time, because at that time we did not know whether, you know, a vaccine would actually ever emerge and whether this kind of fiscal relief would actually be sustainable. But these countries did take a gamble, and this relief was essential in terms of stopping permanent scarring, like in terms of unemployment, breaking supply chains, etc. So the bet has paid off. Emerging markets, some of them have struggled with dealing with the virus, like India, Indonesia. They're not in such great shape. The other problem is that they lack the space for the big fiscal packages. They're also prone to debt crisis, currency crisis, so they've had to be more careful. So they've taken a hit both in terms of lives and livelihoods. Now, on politics, I've been proven wrong. I thought that leaders who control the virus would be appreciated and rewarded. Instead, what has happened, if I look globally, is that many leaders who chose to prioritize livelihoods despite horrifying outcomes in terms of COVID deaths, they seem to be doing fine. So I look at someone like Donald Trump or Bolsonaro in Brazil or even Duterte in Philippines, initially they all questioned, and some continue to question, if this is a serious problem in the first place. They've not paid a political price. Sure, Trump lost, but much of his gains in votes were because many groups, you know, like the fact that he prioritized livelihoods over lives. So going forward, if the economies recover fast, I don't think there will be huge fundamental shifts in the political landscape.
And let's talk about the positives of trade, because that's been an interesting development, hasn't it, as well? I mean, expected nonetheless, but we've seen an increase in perhaps expedited trade links as a result of the pandemic. For example, we recently saw ASEAN ink the world's largest trade pact.
So I think RCEP is a really big deal. The ramifications will be medium to long term rather than in the short term. It could have been an even bigger deal had India chosen to participate in it. So what the deal will do is essentially make it far easier for firms to source cheaper inputs across members. They will avoid these bureaucratic hurdles of what I call local content requirements, which can be an absolute nightmare in terms of deciding, you know, what is the exact level of tariffs to impose. Yes, it'll facilitate movement of goods. So, you know, how will we benefit from it? So as consumers, we'll have cheaper goods. We'll have greater variety of goods. From firms' perspective, they'll have cheaper and better quality inputs, so there are likely to be strong gains from trade. At the same time, in terms of services trade, not much has been achieved. I think of services trade as the future and one of Singapore's key competitive advantages. So I was a little disappointed in this regard. But then half a loaf of bread is better than no bread. So I expect that the scope of this agreement will expand over time, and, you know, this will really benefit the region.
What about some of the smaller trade links that have been developed moving away from RCEP?
So if as a trade economist, you know, the larger the size of these trading arrangements, the more are the efficiency gains. Mm. Otherwise, this creates lots of distortions and leads to something which is called trade diversion, where instead of buying from country B, you buy from country C because, you know, the tariffs are sort of lower. So you're not getting cheaper and best quality stuff. This is just essentially being driven by policies and tariffs which are imposed. So I hope that, you know, either these regional trading arrangements will expand, or going forward that the WTO will actually take a bigger role and push, you know, global trade liberalization going forward. I think that's a much better way. So many of these smaller trade deals are sort of like emergency deals to keep supplies running. You should also keep in mind that it's been quite impressive that despite this huge global pandemic shock, you know, most of the things actually reverted back to normal within a month or so. So that sort of, and there was no global coordinating agency who was doing this. This was essentially being driven by markets and incentives and prices. So there's something to be said about the price mechanism and market mechanisms where, you know, incentives drive people to actually take actions to the benefit of everybody.
Well, Pushan, thank you so much for sharing all your insights with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Pushan Dutt, Professor of Economics and Political Sciences at INSEAD, right here on Primetime on Money FM 89.3.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg. Or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.